to the Utah Puck Report. I'm your host, Jay Stevens. I have a voice.
Yeah, it's back.
Last week I didn't have a voice. I stopped talking so much. Yeah,
that works.
With me, as almost always,
it's Gary Michaels here. Good day.
And then our other almost always,
Jordan Parisi.
So we've got like an official, the three of us, so hopefully we can cover a lot of hockey territory here and ask a lot of knowledgeable questions. I was told a long time ago there are no stupid questions, but there are stupid people that ask questions, and I think I fill that role most of the time.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, okay. I'm excited because going back to the Salt Lake Golden Eagles, there was a mainstay, and it was their trainer was Brian Patafi, and we're lucky to have Brian on the show. Brian, how are you?
You know what, Jay? I'm doing great, and anytime I can talk to somebody from the Salt Lake area, I'm doing that much better. So it's great connecting with you again.
I appreciate that, and I know that you honestly feel that way because we're friends on Facebook, and I follow you on Twitter and Instagram, and you talk all the time about how much you enjoyed your time here in Utah. And what years were you here?
I got there in 1988, the first year Calgary came in, the year after the Wayne Thomas-led Golden Eagles, the green and gold Eagles won the Turner Cup. And then we came in the next year, changed into the Calgary colors with Paul Baxter and Bobby Francis, and we won the cup again that year, and that was the 88. And then I left when Calgary left in 93. And so I was there for six seasons, happiest time of my life when I got there, and the saddest time. And you know this because I've said it over and over again. The saddest time was leaving there.
Yeah, and you know you've written a couple. You've got two books. You've got one book that's on the market now, and one that's about to come out. And you talk mm-hmm. about that a lot, and you talk about that on Facebook. And I love it because, you know, we have some diehard Eagles fans here, and you know the Eagles were around for a long time before that, but it seemed like that Calgary, that era. Just seemed to really solidify the fan base here. And we still have a ton of people that remember those days and remember Chernomaz and the impact that Theron Fleury had on this market in the 2 months or, you know, he wasn't altogether, he wasn't here that long, but man, the impact a guy like that had on this market and just grew the sport.
Let me interject here. You're saying he wasn't there that long. He lived in my basement on 9800 South, 927 East. He was here a long time, okay? Or he was there a long time.
So how long did he live with you?
He actually came in at the end of the end of his junior year and lived there. And then the next year, and he was gone at Christmas. But one of the things that I introduced him to was Scone Cutter and fry sauce. We had never had fry sauce in Canada. And I remember one time pulling through Scone Cutter after an Eagles game, coming home, because they were open late and getting some fries. And they give you this little tub of stuff, and I said, "What is this?" And they go, "That's fry sauce." And I went home and tried it. And if you could marry fry sauce, I would have proposed that night.
Yeah.
And then Theo, I got Theo introduced to it. And it's funny because Theo would come in some nights at 2-3 in the morning. If it was an off night, maybe he'd been down in Wendover, maybe he'd been wherever, but he'd come in 2-3 in the morning. I'd be sound asleep and he would stand in the hallway and he'd rattle the bag. Okay, and I knew it was a Scone Cutter bag, and I'd be up out of bed, and we would sit in the living room and talk for hours eating fries with fry sauce from Scone Cutter.
Oh,
did you get the spicy fries?
You know what? They might have been. I can't remember that part of it. All I do know is every time Theo and I connect, we mention Scone Cutter. It's indelibly printed in our mind, and I need to get a life when Scone Cutter is a highlight of my time.
I cannot tell you how much I love to hear that because the funny thing about Scone Cutter is it was one of my best friends, the best man at my wedding, Terry Warner. It was his dad opened Scone Cutter. He invented Scone Cutter. He started making scones out of his dorm at the U. He was on a football scholarship at the U, started making scones, and they're like, "Hey, you can't make scones on campus. You can't do this out of your dorm. We're gonna. They kicked him out of school, and he opened Scone Cutter.
Yeah, there's still one left. Right?
Yeah, I think there's a couple left.
I was going to say, I don't even know what a Scone Cutter is.
No. Oh, man. No.
So, 90 of South, just off the freeway.
You haven't lived yet.
Yeah.
You don't know what's good. Yeah, you haven't lived yet.
Honey butter?
It's like coming
honey
to Canada
scone?
And saying, you've never had poutine. Oh. You know?
Jordan, have you had fry sauce?
It's just ketchup and mayo, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, I mean, when you say it like that, it doesn't seem like it's that big of a deal, but it's a big deal.
You got to have the right
recipe.
Mix.
Yeah.
Okay? You got to have the right mix.
Yeah, there's a science to it. It's not just ketchup and mayo.
There's
love involved.
It is amazing, though.
And Utah altitude.
Yeah, I admit it is amazing. Yeah.
So I've got another fry sauce story, and it's kind of a weird deal. So Jason Bekashua, who was like a first round draft pick from the Dallas Stars and was assigned here, and he stayed at our house until he found a place to live, and I took him to training table for the first that was the first meal I took him to in Utah.
Oh yeah.
And I'm like, they're like, hey, would you like fry sauce? And I asked him, do you want fry sauce? He's like, is it extra? And I'm like, you just got a $1.3 million signing bonus, and you're asking me if the fry sauce is extra. I'm like, I'm gonna spring the 60 cents and buy your fry sauce. But then he always had it. He loved the fry sauce. But I could not believe a guy with $1.3 million in the bank was worried about the extra 30 cents.
That'd be frugal.
Well, he's just a later day Brian Deasley. Okay.
Wow, Brian Deasley, that's a name from the past.
Well, and I've got to tell you this story because I thought I was in trouble, but actually, let me tell you what happened. Brian Deasley got a $250,000 signing bonus, plus he was on a one-way contract in Salt Lake City. He shows up with a candy apple red vet and a bleach blonde girlfriend, okay? So, like, he's got all the money in the world, right? And but he said, you know, he had one problem. He couldn't play. Okay, he was just playing. So about 3 months into the season, he comes into the training room, and there's about six guys sitting in there. Richie Chernomaz is one of them, and Stewie Grimson's another. And Deasley says to me, he says, Pataf, he goes, I'm having a hard time sleeping at night. I said, well, give some of the money back. Well, it was a quick phone call to his agent. He walked out. He made a quick phone call to his agent. An hour later, I get a call from Cliff Fletcher. Now, I must tell you, when Cliff Fletcher was a GM in Calgary, every time he would call you on speakerphone. And like what we talked earlier before we went on the podcast here, it sounds like he's calling from the bottom of the Grand Canyon. So anyway, he goes, Pataf, Cliff Fletcher. Well, he didn't have to introduce himself over the phone. He's the only guy I ever talked to on speakerphone. And I said, yes, Cliff. He goes, I got a question for you, and I want you to play out the whole scenario that happened with Deasley this morning. And I said, well, Cliff, you know, I apologize, sir. I am sorry. He goes, I didn't call you for an apology. I want the whole scenario. I heard from his agent. So I tell Cliff the whole story right down to the, you know, hey, why don't you give some of the money back? Then I hear this laughter. He's got the whole hockey staff up in his office because they just thought that was the greatest line they had ever heard. I'm thinking I'm getting fired, and they just want a comedy show.
That's fantastic.
You were always good for a comedy show, though. That's funny.
Well, you know, anybody who does what I do for a living for 41 years, they got to find some humor in what they do.
Yeah, so. For sure. So 41 years, man. So awesome.
Yeah.
How did you get into it?
Well, in 1977, 78, my final year of university, I was studying to become a physical therapist, and I was getting my PT degree, my bachelor's and my PT degree, and at that time, hockey teams, the WHA was still around, and hockey teams were hiring educated guys to be their athletic trainer. And they were hiring equipment managers. They were no longer hiring the guy that couldn't make the team or hung around the rink or whatever to do both. And you know what? No disrespect to those guys because, you know what, they worked hard and they did a good job. But, you know, the salaries were starting to creep up a bit. The WHA was putting a lot of pressure on the NHL to spend more money on their players. And they wanted their players better taken care of. So I got my PT degree and my athletic training certificate in Canada, and I said, you know what? This is what I'm going to do for a living. My father was livid. You know, I took a job in Utica, New York, my very first year, 1978-79, in Utica, New York, and that's where they filmed the part of Slapshot where the players got in a fight in the warm-up. They called it Peterborough, but it was Utica, New York, where that was filmed. And so, you know, this was after the film and everything, and I went to Utica and took this job. I was getting $230 a week plus a soda pop machine that I could put in the locker room and make money off of that as well.
Wow.
Yeah. And then it went from there. I kept trying to move up the ladder. Told myself if I wasn't in the National League by the time I was 30 years old, I was going to get out of the game and go into a private practice. And when I turned 30 years old, I moved to Salt Lake City. And you know what? I didn't go to the National League. I went to heaven.
Yeah. I love that.
And this isn't a snow job. You know this, Jay, because even when I ran into you at PHATS a few years ago, I told you when you were working for that the sporting goods company, I told you then, I said, my goodness, I miss Utah.
Yeah.
I miss Utah. And it just it was, you know, it was just a good, like, I went, and you got to understand, I went from Utah, where you could get all kinds of culture and learn all kinds of stuff, to St. John, New Brunswick, and when they moved the team there. And in St. John, New Brunswick, the only way to get culture is to go to the grocery store and buy yogurt. You know? I love Utah.
Yeah.
I loved it.
No, and having guys like you here that appreciated being here, and I don't know if you're following what's going on. There's so much talk. Well, actually, I do know that you're following what's going on because I saw your little argument the other with McCluskey. So there's a lot of talk back and forth about Utah going to the AHL and why they are, why they're not, and actually Utica's coming up. But it's when people start talking and you get a lot of people that say, oh, nobody wants to come to Utah because of this or that and that. But then you have guys like you that have been here that came from other hockey markets. So they're like, Utah is top secret, one of the best markets to play in because, you know, it's a big market in a small market. And you've got, you know, you've got mountains, you've got everything you want. You want to be
You're treated like a big leaguer.
Yeah.
Like you know what? Like we came in and the Jazz were in their heyday. They went to the finals a couple of years, a couple of years in a row while we were there. And we weren't on the back page of the sports. We were, you know what? I mean, the Jazz, obviously they're a major league team and they, you know, they command that, but we were getting really good coverage, like excellent coverage. And I remember a beat writer with the Deseret News traveling with us during the playoffs and I remember Mike Runge when he was on TV, before he took over as our GM. You know, he's always, promoting the Eagles. Well, and I say promoting, it's not a reported job to promote the team, but I've always said any press is good press. Even bad press is good press, you know, because your name is getting out there and you're creating a brand. And branding now, like today, that's everything about everything, you know, whether you're in the British Columbia Hockey League like I am, or whether you're in the National Hockey League. I don't know if you've really realized or noticed, but after the lockout where the NHL locked the players out for the full year and they didn't have a season at all that year, the next year, when players were doing interviews, they were wearing a ball cap with their team's logo on it. They weren't pushing Joe's Car Wash or Flexol there were no side deals going on. You know, I remember when I was in the NHL and we were in Edmonton and Dave Gagne got told by our PR guy, CBC, Hockey Night in Canada, wants to interview you between periods. So Dave goes under install into his equipment bag, and he's looking, and he's yelling at our equipment guy. He goes, Bobby, I don't have my Louisville hat, because Dave got paid for wearing a Louisville Slugger hat,
yep.
If he did an interview. And he goes, Bobby, you forgot to pack it. And I came out of the training room. I said, Gags, I said, we left right after practice yesterday. I said, you guys packed your own bags. So our equipment manager and the PR guy, first they went over the Edmonton room. They didn't have one. So they spent the afternoon at the West Edmonton Mall going into a place equivalent to Lids and buying a Louisville Slugger hat so Gagne would do his interview. Otherwise, he wasn't going to do the interview.
Wow.
So that all stopped after the lockout, all the freebies, you know, and things like that, the free advertising. You're going to advertise either the NHL logo or your team logo, and that's it.
I used to be one of the guys making those side deals. So, as an equipment rep, and Jordan knows because I tried to get his brother to do it a lot. And I tried to get you to do it when you were in North Dakota. I would go and be like, "Hey, wear this T-shirt when they interview you after," because that was part of my job. But yeah, I didn't notice that they'd eliminated that.
Well, I remember going to Al Coates, who was our GM in Calgary when I was up there, and I said, Al, I just got a call. I ordered Flexol. You know, you remember the Flexol?
Oh, yeah.
I said, Al, I just ordered Flexol, and I gave him a PO number, and they said, oh, no, Brian, we got to talk to you. And so I said, they told me that I get all the Flexol I want free, plus I get a $1,500 check at Christmas and a $1,500 check at the end of the year as long as I keep our guys in Flexol T-shirts and hats. And I said, well, what is this $1,500 for? And they told me it was a consulting fee. I said, well, what do I have to do, write up protocols for you? And they go, no, you just have to make sure your guys are wearing our T-shirts in interviews. And this is before the lockout. So I went to Al Coates because I didn't know if this was kosher. And I'd spent my life trying to get to the National League, and I didn't want to get fired over over $3,000 total, you know?
Right, right.
And Coates said, so we're not paying for it. And I said, no. He goes, then take it. You know, it's like, good for you.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
And so I'll tell you, I had my whole family in Flexol shirts, you know? Yeah, my family used to be disappointed at Christmas when I was in the National League because, you know, they get things like Flexol shirts and Flexol hats and sanitary socks and stuff like that. Whatever I could get for free. Kids knew in Calgary if they came to my door on Halloween, they were getting either chewing gum or a puck.
That's nothing wrong with that. You got to do what you got to do. I like it.
It's like those race car guys, though. Yeah. You know, they're all decked out in all the logos.
Yeah.
Look, I spent 2 years working over in Europe. In Frankfurt and in the DEL too, and you want to talk advertising? They've got it, and I'd seen pictures on, you know, they had advertising on the pants and everything else, and I said, man, I'd hate to be an equipment guy over there trying to sew that on. Well, it's all Velcroed on. The pants, CCM and Bauer make their European pants that have Velcro in those areas so that they can Velcro on these ads.
Well, and then even all my goalie gear, like they would, it wasn't anything, nothing was Velcro, but they would just have like this rubber cement that they would basically put on the entire front part of your equipment and then just slap some logo on top of that, or else they would completely take, you know, for my blocker, they would completely take the entire front panel off, you know, the leather stitching and everything, and then stitch in the whatever logo, whether it was, you know, a jewelry company or something.
Yeah, it was amazing. And it's funny because they had these things for the goalie paddle. And we were advertising. I can't even remember the company, but we had a short goalie, and the whole thing wouldn't fit. So I cut it, but I didn't realize I had not only changed the spelling of the word in the ad, but it was profanity that was on there. But I got the owner coming down to me during the game. And he goes, 9, 9, 9, and I go, no, he wears 30.
That's awesome. No. Now that's the Brian Patafia I know. Jordan, didn't you try to fight that? Like you snapped the first time they were putting.
Well, so my first team that I went to go play for was Red Bull, and so like I had my New Jersey Devils helmet, and they were like, "Hey, we're going to paint over that." I'm like, "No, there's no way that you're painting over it." And next thing you know, like they took my helmet and painted it, and
it looked like a Red Bull can.
It looked like a Red Bull can.
I remember you were so. Like,
Were you Red Bull in Munich or
in Salzburg?
In Salzburg.
Yep.
Please tell me Pierre Paget wasn't your coach.
He was my coach. That was the downfall of my career.
Oh, you know what? I can get you the copy of my prescription that I had to take after 4 years with that guy.
I mean, that is an entirely different podcast. But there's so many players that we could bring on this right now for a Pierre Pagé podcast. But, yeah, it was he was definitely an interesting cat to play for. He was a guy that he would ask you questions. Like, for me, he came up and brought me in the locker room one day, and he's just like, hey, you know, I want to talk to you about our defensive zone and our penalty kill. I was like, yeah, perfect. And he started saying, you know, we do this. What do you think of that? And I'm like, well, you know, I would prefer if we played, you know, our defensive zone, if we played more of like a zone as opposed to a man-on-man. He's like, oh, okay, yeah, it sounds good. And then asked me about our penalty kill and told him a couple things on that. And he's like, yeah, it sounds good. The next day, nothing was changed. And Pierre stopped talking to me for the rest of the season because he felt as though I was against him and against his teaching. So then all of a sudden he was trying to find reasons to not play me. He wouldn't speak. It was the craziest deal. And I kept watching him do this with other guys on the team. And all of a sudden guys would just like sit randomly. He's like, yeah, I went and talked to Pierre. I thought the meeting went great. Next thing you know, I'm sitting for a week.
Wow.
That is nuts.
I'll tell you, when we were in Boston. And we're on the top floor of the Copley Plaza. We're having dinner up there. And Pierre thought he would be, you know, he'd get all psychological. And he goes, you know, guys, I'm going to tell you something. He goes, I got $101 American bills in my hand. Now, I could throw these out the window and make maybe one person on the ground happy or possibly make 100 people on the ground happy. And Theo Fleury goes, why don't you just jump out and make everybody happy?
That's bad.
I don't know.
That's awesome.
I don't know the guy, but I got a pretty good picture of him now.
Well, how do you handle that? No. Jordan, how do you handle that situation when you're in there?
When your coach is doing things like that?
What do you
I mean, ultimately, I didn't re-sign there.
Right.
You know, it came to the end of the season, it came for negotiations, and the kind of the way they do it in Europe, like, oh yeah, you know, just go home for a couple of days and then get back in touch with us, and then all of a sudden I start calling back and none of the lines work.
Oh.
You know, and then, you know, so that was kind of the way that he worked. He threw this bait out there to see if you were with him or against him, and if you were against him, or not even outwardly, just, you know, he would throw these little psychological games at you, and if you didn't go the appropriate route, like, he would, you know, exile you. It was the strangest things. And I know that even in, I want to say it's Fleury's book, he talks a lot about Pierre and just some of the weird things that he would do. And there was this isn't a bash on Pierre conversation, but, you know, there was definitely times where he would kind of take advantage of the fact that there were rookies on the team, and he would kind of go after them and make examples out of them. And you know, I got to witness this firsthand. And then next thing you know, you go and you watch different videos of you know, back in the day when he was a coach for the Quebec Nordiques, and he's sitting there just tearing a strip off of Matt Sundin when he was a rookie. And Matt Sundin ended up, you know, he was a legend then and then became even more of a legend. But, like, that's what he would kind of do, is go after those young guys and kind of, you know, make them. It was a bizarre situation. So ultimately, I, you know, didn't have the opportunity to re-sign there.
Right. Man, that's...
But you know what, and the thing is, and that's not an anomaly in with European teams. I'll tell you, I was in Frankfurt, and instead of going back the next year, I was going to go to Ingolstadt in the DEL. It was, as far as I'm concerned, I was moving up a league. It was, you know, the money wasn't going to be that much better. It's just a better league.
Right.
And so I thought I did the right thing, would do the right thing to tell the owner with a month left, you know, you're on the 9-month contract. So I told him the 1st of April. Well, not only at the end of April was there no paycheck in my bank, but I showed up at the airport and my plane ticket had been canceled home.
You
know? Yeah.
Wow.
So now, so you stand in the Frankfurt airport and buy a ticket at the gate, not at the gate, but, you know, at the airline thing there, and try buying a ticket and try getting an Expedia price there. It ain't happening.
Right, right.
Yeah, wow. I dropped €1,900 on my credit card.
Yep.
And I got back to North Carolina. My wife goes, €1,900. I said, Yeah, I said, I'm taking him to court. So I flew home first class. I said, so anyway, fortunately, Germany is, they are employee friendly.
Definitely.
Okay, so, I mean, it did go to court. And walking up the steps of the courtroom, to the courtroom, my lawyer, and I bought lawyer's insurance when I went. I'd never heard of such a thing. But when I got to Germany, Rich Turnemat says, hey, buy lawyer's insurance. I said, what is lawyer's insurance? He goes, if they screw you here, your lawyer covers you. You're not paying him. He covers you. And I go, well, how much is it? He goes, $25 a month. I said, okay, you know, for 20 or 25 euro a month. So I bought lawyer's insurance. So my lawyer is walking up the steps of the courtroom. I'm here in Chilliwack, British Columbia, and I'm on WhatsApp with my lawyer, right? And they're walking up the steps, and Stephen Kramer says, oh, so he says, listen, he said, I owe him 4,500 euro and his plane ticket. I pay that right now. And my lawyer goes, have you read this book? And he's showing him my original book. He goes, yeah. He goes, I have. He goes, you don't want to read his next one. And Kramer goes, what you mean? He goes, there's probably 50 pages dedicated to you, and it ain't free. I walked with 20,000 euro.
Wow. See, yeah, and that's a good...
that's excellent.
You know, Germany, it's good that you brought that up, because Germany was definitely on the fairer side with making sure that players were taken care of. My brother, and you'll appreciate this, Brian, my brother was playing with Peter Sikora with the Devils. And this was during that lockout period, or the year after the lockout period. And so what ended up happening was Peter Sikora went over to play in Russia and, you know, signed a good deal there for a couple million or something, and then came back home. And the team still owed him like $700,000. And Peter Sikora, you know, called the team and couldn't get a hold of the team, finally got a hold of the team and said, hey, you know, and this is over in Russia, or he was in the States and he was calling Russia, and the whoever he was talking with, the manager, the general manager of the team in Russia, he says, hey, Peter says, hey, you know, you guys still owe me a bunch of money. And all that he heard on the other line was, come and get it. And then a click.
Wow.
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 So it's a little bit different in Russia and in Germany. But,
oh, yeah. So
I'm not going to go get it.
I'm good.
Just wire that over.
Probably my deductions.
Right.
I'm afraid of even when the telemarketers call from Russia. I feel like it's a life or death call. You know, there's no way. Yeah. That's crazy.
Brian, how long have you been with Chilliwack, by the way?
It's my second year here.
Second year, okay.
And this is. This is going to be it for me. I mean, you know, at my age, I'm 64. I tried retiring in 2015, and it didn't work. You know, it just didn't work for me. I went back to North Carolina, where you know, my wife is from, and you know, just tried hanging it up, and you know, I had a pension coming in from Calgary, and you know, I was in a good situation financially. But mentally, I did not handle retirement well. And I think my wife used the best analogy when she said, you know, you're like a prisoner that just got let out of prison after 30 plus years. You can't handle the outside. You got to go back in, man. Yeah. You know? And she was right. And I said, well, you know what? The kids are seniors in high school now, and I don't want to move them again, because she is a trooper. She moved with me, and I was a bit of a nomad after my Salt Lake days, and she moved everywhere with me. We had kids, you know, and she said, well, why don't we just do where you take a job and we'll come and visit periodically in your home in the summer. I said, okay, I'll do that. That, you know, if you're okay with it. So a couple weeks later, I went to her and I said, look, I picked up a job. And she goes, where? I said, in Frankfort. She goes, Frankfort, Kentucky? I didn't even know they had a team. I said, no, it's in Frankfurt, Germany. And she goes, well, I guess we're not going to drive to see you, are we? You know? She thought I'd go like to Charleston, you know, a couple hours down the road, or even, you know, even somewhere in Florida. But Frankfurt, you know, getting to hook back up with Rich Turnemaz and work for a guy, Paul Gardner was coaching over there. You know, I had fun. I had a lot of fun. And they wanted a North American trainer. And I'm going to tell you what happened my first week over there, because you'll appreciate this. okay? And this is how the German culture works, and I love the culture in Germany, but this is how people think. So 4 days into our first week, we're playing our opening game in Bietigheim. And so we're into Thursday at practice, and the equipment guy says to me, and we call him an equipment guy, but he couldn't sharpen skates, and he wasn't allowed to order.
Wow.
So I had to order, I had to sharpen skates. He was more of the grunt worker, you know, but he called himself the equipment manager or over there, the betrayer. So he says to me, he says, good luck in Bietigheim tomorrow. I go, well, what do you mean good luck? He goes, oh, I hit 40 hours. I'm not coming. Like, legally, they can't make you work more than 40 hours a week in Germany.
Yeah.
So he had hit 40 hours. So I said, no, you're coming. And he goes, nine. And every time somebody say nine, I'd think of Bobby Hull, you know, or Gordie Howe. Nine. And that's another story. But anyway, and I'm going to share that story with you in a minute. So anyway, I go into Paul Gardner. I said, Gards, Rene told me he's not traveling tomorrow. He hit 40 hours. He goes, you better go talk to Cherno. So I go down to Cherno's office. I said, Cherno, Rene tells me he's not coming to Bietigheim tomorrow. He's already hit 40 hours. And Cherno goes, have you not monitored him? I said, monitored him? He goes, yes. He goes, when he throws in that first load of wash after practice, you're supposed to send him home. Because he'll sit there and watch the wash go around and around and around and watch TV. And he goes, and add his hours up. He goes, you've got to monitor him so that you have him on the road. Well, I'm going, Cherno, you never told me this. He goes, if I did, you'd have never come over. You know? So anyway, I go solo to Bietigheim. Then the next week, you know, Rene would get the jerseys, the practice jerseys thrown in, and I go home. And I said, nine my rear end. And I didn't use the word rear end. But, you know, I said, go home. And so that's what I was doing all week. So now, Cherno had ordered the first, and I want to tell you about nine. Cherno had ordered the first order of sticks for everybody, and then it was up to me to order from that point on. And so I call our CCM rep, because we had a contract with CCM, and I call the rep, and he's in Austria, and he goes, oh, a stick order. You order half dozen, nine, or 12. And I said, okay. I said, give me the, let's go through the roster. And he goes, Hannibal Weitzman. I said, nine. He goes, Florian Prosky. I said, nine. He goes, Mike Card. I said, 12. Brett Breichreutz, 12. Tim Schula, nine. And I went through the whole roster. So anyway, he goes, so you want 24 total sticks. I said, no, I just gave you the order. He goes, yes. Hannibal Weitzman, nine. Brody Frosty, nine. Tim Schula, nine. I go, yeah. I said, we're already at 27. How? I go, you know. So he's not getting it. He's thinking I'm saying no. I'm thinking I'm saying nine. I said, okay, let's start over. He goes, okay. Hannibal Weitzman, 12. Florian Frosty, 12. I didn't care.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I love it. But, so, yeah.
Well, my German was very limited, you know, and even after, you know, the first year over there, it was still very limited, you know, but I knew how to say good morning and Dankeschön.
Yeah. Nice.
And every time I'd say Dankeschön, I'd break out into the song.
Of course.
You know, the Wayne Newton. Yep. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's how we learn it. So tell us, you know, it was a, well, first I want to talk to you about the huge impact you had on me in Salt Lake, because and I don't know if you remember this, maybe you do, and I know I may have mentioned to you when I used to, because I was an equipment rep for 12 years, 15 years, something like that, and I'd run into you at your trainer shows every year. And for me, when I first got out of here and I was going to Shattuck St. Mary's, excuse me, I had horrible equipment, and they were kind of like, hey, look, I was getting pretty dinged up, and they're like, you clearly can't stay here, because I had the old brown Cooper leg pads, and I had a terrible chest pad that was a two piece. I don't know, the old two piece that had the cotton.
I remember that. Yeah.
And a baseball chest protector, and I was just getting like deep bone bruises to the point where the trainers there were like, hey, you can't play. You got to figure something out. And I came home because I was there for the summer, and then right as school was getting ready to start. Somehow I got in touch with you. I'd never met you before, and you were like, look, you took care of me. You had just got back. Somehow we got Sean Burke's Olympic leg pads.
Yeah, like, the Bryants.
Yeah, the Bryants.
Yeah.
And you gave me that pair of the full set of Sean Burke pads, and that's what I wore when I went back there. And then I ended up only staying at Shattuck for a couple months, and I came back to Utah, and I wore those pads. I wore those pads for probably the next 8 years. Until I got to a school that could afford to pay for equipment for me. But that was the difference between making it and not making it, is finally getting equipment.
Well, you know, and I really appreciate that because, you know, hearing that it's pretty gratifying, because I remember Mazzotti was the one trying the Bryan's equipment, and they sent it. And then they said, well, just keep it, do something with it, whatever. They didn't want it back. You know, they did back then. The companies were unbelievable. Some of the stuff that they would drop in, and it was probably well documented. You know, our first few years there, that Art Teese was losing a ton of money running that team.
Yeah.
And fortunately, with the Calgary connection and the connections we were making with equipment companies, we were getting stuff sent in there left and right and not being charged for it. You know, a lot of sample stuff and stuff like that. We had remember the Albany Choppers lasted like 3 months in the IHL, and they phoned on their road trip in. They go, we can't get sticks, and we supplied them with sticks when they came in, because we just had a ton of sticks that the companies were sending us to try and coerce. Like Cherno was a Sherwood guy and he wasn't changing, but Coho or Canadian wanted him, you know, in their stick, and they'd send all these samples, and Cherno, no, I'm not interested, you know. So they went over to Albany, you know, to that team when they came in, and we just had a pile of equipment in there, and so you know, I'm glad something like that, you know, that helped you out. And I know there's a couple other guys there too that used to get sticks from us, or we'd sharpen their skates and help them out. And we really tried to get involved in the minor hockey there. I remember, you know, a couple of the players running camps over at Cottonwood and Cottonwood Heights, and then out in Bountiful. Those were the only two other indoor rinks at the time before the Olympics came in. And I remember spending, you know, a ton of time there. And if the Jazz played on a Monday night, then we practice in Bountiful at 8 o'clock in the morning. And if they played on a Wednesday night, we were at, Cottonwood, and then none of us played on Sundays, which I thought was great, which I don't know if it's still like that in Utah with the Jazz but nobody back then, nobody played on Sundays. And if we were on the road, that was a different kettle of fish. But you know what? If we were not on the road on a Sunday, we knew we had that day off in Salt Lake.
And it's pretty much still like that, yeah. The Grizzlies typically have Sunday off, and the Jazz typically have Sunday off. That's nice. It's a good day to catch up, for sure. It's a good family day.
Oh, yeah. It really is. It really is.
So tell me about what you remember at the end, because like you talk about it a lot in your book about the heartbreak and then the mistake you thought of pulling Calgary out of Salt Lake. And
well, here was the thing: Cliff moved the team there, and you know, when he moved the team there, the Canadian dollar was at about 60 cents. So you know, but he knew it going in. But he said, you know what? It's a wash, because we got our guys in the same time zone. We can call them in the morning and have them up here that night, you know, and it happened a few times. I remember Steve Gannett going up, like we're having morning practice, we'd get the call, and he'd be on a flight at 1 o'clock, and he'd be in Calgary by 3, and he'd be backing up that night. You know, Daryl Olson, same thing. Cherno, Patty LeBeau, Todd Harkins, all these kids, you know, and it was going great. Then I'm going to tell you what happened in my mind, and first of all, I am an advocate for Larry H. Miller when he bought the team, because if he didn't buy the team, we were done. Because Art just didn't have the money, and Calgary didn't want to own their own franchise. They didn't mind paying players. They didn't mind paying training staff to be there. They did not want the day-to-day operational costs. And if they did, it was going to be in Canada because of the value of the dollar. So Larry buys a team, and everything's fine and dandy for the 2 years he had it at the Salt Palace. Well, then he's going to build his own arena, and I got to do what every trainer in the world would love to do. I got to be in on the design of our locker room in the Delta Center. And we had a locker room that knocked it out of the park. I'm sure you remember it, Jay. I'm sure you'd gone through it. But, you know, we had a player lounge, huge coach's office, a whole bit. The trainer's room was to die for. I had Pioneer Valley Hospital outfitting the trainer's room with all their equipment. You know, we use the Sports Medicine Center out there. And then Larry, you know what? Larry spent all the money that needed to be spent. We had a sauna that held 24 guys. 24 guys. Like, the whole team. We could have held a meeting in the sauna. You know? So, anyway, Riseborough comes down, and he walks through the facility, and I'm all proud, and he's upset. He looks at Tim Howells, and he goes, "This isn't how players are supposed to pay the price in the minors." And I look at Doug and I go, "Doug, how much did you play in the minors?" Well, Doug never played in the minors. Right. He might have had a game or two with the Montreal Voyageurs when they played out of the Forum, but Doug didn't have any amount of time in the minors. But he thought the players should be paying the price. Well, they weren't paying the price.
Financially.
On the 15th and the 30th. And so that's it. You know, at the time, it was the difference between 60,000 and 600,000.
Yeah.
And the gap's even bigger now. But he did not like the fact, you know, and he called it a country club. And we were only in the Delta Center 2 years. So they started negotiating with a group in St. John, New Brunswick, to move the team there. And I'm livid. I am livid. And I will tell you, I got a phone call with about 4 months left in our season from Mike Milbury, who was the GM of the Islanders then.
Yeah.
And he goes, "Brian," and I knew Mike. I'd run into him before when he used to be with the Maine Mariners. And he goes, "Brian," he goes, "I hear you're doing a good job and you just love it there." I said, "This is the greatest place in the world." And he goes, "Well, between you and I, we're putting our farm team there." And I said, "Really?" And he goes, "Yeah." And he goes, "I'd like to offer you the position." So I said, "Mike, I want you to be honest with me." I said, "I want you to be 100% honest with me." And he goes, "No other way to be." I said, "Are you offering me this position because you think I'm a good trainer and I've made an impact here? Or are you offering me this position because I'm already here and you're going to save a crap load of money not moving somebody here?" He goes, "It's a little bit of both."
Yeah.
I said, "Okay, I'm not interested."
You know, at least he was honest.
I'm not. Yeah, he was honest. You know, and that, you know what, like, say what you want about Mike Milbury, he'll tell you what's on his mind. He will tell you. You know?
Yeah, he definitely seems to be that type.
Yeah. And so, you know, and then, you know, the team lasted one more year, and then, you know, for whatever reason, you know, Detroit bought it. So regardless, even if Detroit made me part of that, you know, move, I would have been heartbroken just a year later.
Right.
But, you know, everything leading up to it was so clandestine. And it was really, and then all coaches would come down and tell me, "Oh, you're going to love it in St. John. Oh, you're going to love it in St. John." I said, "No, I'm not. I'm not going to love it in St. John. I grew up in the Canadian Maritimes, and the reason I got an education was so I didn't have to live there."
I was going to ask you a question on, you know, because when I was in the minors in New Jersey, Lou Lamoriello, like, made it a point to, the team was just being moved to Lowell from Albany, And I think that they had just purchased for their coast team the Trenton Devils.
Trenton Devils, yeah.
And so I know that Lou like went out of his way to make sure I'm gonna make this as great of an experience as possible. I mean, neither team won games, but like he went right into Lowell and put a couple $1 million into that arena so that we had our own little section. Sure that everything was upgraded, updated. Everything was perfect. He was one of those general managers that didn't want to get pigeonholed into any of those AHL rules that made you use CCM gear or sticks.
Yeah.
So he was always, if you talk to anybody that has ever played for Lou, everybody will tell you the exact same thing. Like, the only thing that he cares about is his players. And that's the one thing that I loved about Lou. I don't want to cut you off, but I was going to ask you as kind of like a segue to this. Out of all the organizations that you've been to or been with, what has been like the best experience for you, whether it's in, the American League, the NHL, over in Europe? What have you enjoyed the best?
When Cliff Fletcher was the GM in Calgary and he put the team in Salt Lake, by far, greatest experience. I love the cultural experience going over to Germany and reconnecting with our captain from Salt Lake. I love that. But when Cliff was the GM in Calgary and put the team in Salt Lake, Cliff and Lou Lamoriello are cut from the same cloth. Just for example, I was in Moncton. That's where Calgary had their farm team in the AHL. And my contract was up in my third year. And then they're moving the fourth year to Salt Lake. So I figured, Cliff's going to make a business decision. I'm just a trainer. And Cliff called me up. He goes, we're going to make an announcement. And I knew they were going to Salt Lake. He says, we're going to make an announcement in 2 days. He said, I just want to make sure that you're okay to move with us to Salt Lake City because I want to make that part of the announcement. Well, I was like, floored. Like, this guy's going to move me to Salt Lake. And I go, absolutely, Cliff. I took the job here in Moncton, to work for the Calgary Flames. And, because I if the Calgary Flames aren't in Moncton, I don't want to be in Moncton. So anyway, out of his next breath, he goes, okay, I'm going to call you the day of the announcement. So they make the announcement, and I don't hear from them. But they did say that I would be going. I was going to be one of the, people from Moncton that was going to Salt Lake. Well, then it was 2 days later, he called me. He said, sorry, I was supposed to call you. He goes, Pataf, financially, it'll be better for you to buy a place in Salt Lake. You can take your interest off your mortgage. You can take it off your taxes. Tax-wise, it's going to be so much better for you. I said, Cliff, as much as that sounds great, I don't have any American money to put down on a place. He goes, oh, okay. Find out what you're going to need to put down. That's going to be your signing bonus. He goes, I want the minimum. He goes, don't come to me and say they want 50% because I know you're full of, So anyway, I called Diane Teese, who was Art Teese's daughter, and she was a realtor, and I called her, and she said, you can get in for 3% down, your first-time buyer. I said, okay. So I called Cliff, and I said, 3%. And back then in Utah, you could get a nice house for $60,000, a nice house.
Crazy.
And I told Cliff that. He goes, if you find a $60,000 house that you're happy with, I'll give you 15% to put down on it.
Cool.
Well, wow. I found a $60,000 house in Sandy, and I was very happy with it. And Cliff to his word, that was my signing bonus. And then he gave me a $2,500 move-in allowance in case I had to change a carpet or put up a fence or whatever. Nobody does that anymore.
I was just going to say that. You don't hear about, you just don't hear this anymore.
Yeah. But you know what? I've talked to guys in the Jersey organization too, and my experience with New Jersey is my first year in Augusta, Georgia. New Jersey had a secondary working agreement there, and we had a kid named Henry Kuster who blew his ACL, and we sent him up to Jersey, and Henry said, "I want the doctor in Augusta to operate on me, and I want to work with the trainer there and do my rehab there." and Lou and I can't remember the trainer's name from Jersey, but he knew me from my time in Calgary. But anyway, Lou and the trainer called me and they said, Henry's, you know, wished to do this and blah, blah, blah. And I said, yeah, I'm more than willing to work with it. And I know Dr. Duncan here will do a great job with him and everything else. He says, well, will you keep in touch with us? And I, you know, and I did. And I got a nice letter from Lou at the end of the year thanking me for the work I did with Henry. But Lou kept it. You know, Lou would call Henry. Henry never played a game in Jersey.
Right.
But he was part of their organization.
Yep.
You know.
I know.
Which, no, you don't see that anymore.
When I got hurt, I mean, the first thing that Lou did was ask me, you know, and tell me, hey, just so you know, the best hip surgeon in the world right now is in Vail, Colorado. And he flew me there first class and put me up in the Four Seasons for 2 weeks. And, you know, all my rehab that I had to do there in Vail. And, you know, it was, you know, just an... He just did everything properly.
Didn't he fly your mom out there too?
My mom and dad, yeah.
Yeah, unreal.
Yeah, that's amazing. And those are the feel good stories, and those kind of things are what keeps guys like you and I coming back. You know what I mean? Like many people have told me, you know, you're not going to see that again. You're not going to see that again. You know what? I'm seeing it out here at a different level in Chilliwack. They built a program out here. They want to do it right. The gentleman that owns the team also owns the building, so we're not like a redheaded stepchild in here. You know, there's
right.
Two pads of ice, and we're never out of the building. Jay, you've seen. I've posted pictures of our locker room, and
oh, yeah.
You know, we've got a big league setup here. You know, player lounge, and you know, and a video, like a video theater, the whole bit. It's amazing.
Yeah, it all looks amazing. It looks like you're just happy there, too. I love it.
Well, you know what? Working with teenagers, I'll tell you, it can be a challenge.
I bet.
Can be a challenge because, you know, there's things that we as adults sort of just kind of take for granted. And, you know, I'm amazed because in pro hockey, if a game's over at, let's say, 5 to 10, the athletic trainers usually leave in about 11:30. You know, guys are rolling out, flushing, riding the bike, whatever, and you're usually out of the building by 11:30. I'm in my car at 10:45, and I'm going, where did everybody go? You know, and like you have to train them. You have to go, guys. We play tomorrow night, so no, you're not running out the door. You know, you're not going home to play Fortnite for 4 hours. You know, you got to do this, and this. But you know what? They love the fact that you know I only had a cup of coffee in the National League. In fact, I didn't even have a chance to add cream to that coffee, but. They love to hear the stories. And Brian Kilrey told me a great story on my second go-around in Ottawa. He goes, you're in the National League for 3 years. He goes, you got 15 years worth of stories from there. You know, and it's true. You know, it's just like oh, yeah, maybe it did happen in the American League. But, oh, we can make it.
You know? Yeah. All right, Tass, we're running out of time. I want to give you an opportunity to tell us about your book that's about to come out.
Okay, well, my new book coming out, and it's funny because young Domi took the same title for his book, No Days Off, but my publisher wasn't giving up the title. We came with a subtitle, much as we did with my last book. My last book, I Sit Down and Look at Pro Hockey Through a Trainer's Eyes. This one's No Days Off, The Story of a Hockey Purgatory. Now, this book gets in deep and talks about, you know, issues in the game that I've had to face, you know, i.e. like Germany and stuff like that, you know, internal stuff that, you know, guys worked as 40 hours and stuff like that. But it was set to come out December 15th, and the first part of December I got on the phone with the publisher because there is probably 3 or 4 chapters where names are named. And you know, I said some things that were, like, they were honest, but you know what? I don't want to be that guy that's going to have a guy blackballed, lose his job, whatever.
Right.
So, you know what? I said no. And the publisher said to me, Brian, look at what my first book came out in November. He goes, look at what your January residual check was. Because, you know, at the Christmas rush and everything, you know, this is a $20 book sitting on an end cap up by the cash. People were buying it. You know?
Yeah.
He goes, you're going to lose money. I said, I don't care. I'm not going to lose my integrity. And I know this might sound like lip service, but you know what? I've seen things that guys have done. You know what? They're going to face a bigger judge than Brian Patafi.
Right.
You know? And then they're going to answer to him.
Right.
Okay? So, you know what? No, I'm rewriting some of the chapters. There was a little go back and forth about it and stuff like that. I said, well, then we can just cut all that out. Well, there'd be gaps in the book, you know? So I'm doing a rewrite. And finally, you know what? We're all on the same page. So we're hoping the end of April. And if not, it might be Christmas again. But again, like, you know what? Bill Peters lost his job over something that happened years ago, whether it was right or wrong. And, the difference I'm not an evangelical, but the difference between me when I was in Utah and me today is I have the Lord in my life, and Jesus said, those of you without sin, cast the first stone, okay? So, you know, we've all want a do-over somewhere in our life, and so, you know what, I'm not going to be responsible for another Bill Peters or you know, the equipment guy in Colorado. With the AHL team. No, not me. Not coming for me. I've made a living from this game. I'm not going to make a living cutting this game apart.
That's awesome, man. I totally appreciate that, and that speaks to your integrity. And I get that. We all have made mistakes, and it's in this cancel culture, as they call it now. It's tough because you never know what's going to come out. Like, what stupid thing did you say that somebody remembered 20 years ago that could get that, you know, that could cost you your job now? So
I pretty much know that I'm done from some of the things that I said 20 years ago.
Yeah. So,
well, you know what? We can build a commune in Tooele. You know?
I want to do just real quick here. So Brian, I've never met you before, but I do know how incredibly hard you guys work, and you kind of have like a thankless, you're just, thankless job, and you're kind of the unsung hero that's behind the scenes of everything. So, I've had some amazing trainers in my time that really just are behind the scenes. They don't want the limelight, and you know, they just never get thanked. So, on behalf of all of us players that are done or current, you know, thank you and thank all of your group of guys that take care of all of us.
Well, you know what? I really appreciate that. When you hear it from a player, an ex-player, it just means that much more. And you know, you've got some pretty good NHL DNA in you, and I really appreciate that. And you know what? We're all kind of in this brotherhood together. And you know, if I was a player, I'd be retired now. So I think I got the best job in hockey, because the big joke here in Chilliwack is they carry an empty stick bag on the road because they may be bringing me home in it someday.
Well, Brian, you've been amazing. I can't thank you enough for being on the show, and thanks for helping getting my start so I could have this amazing career as an e-bug and then a podcaster. Wasn't exactly the way I planned it all out, but it's more than I deserved and more than I ever thought I'd make it to. And again, that the start comes from you just making a simple phone call and helping me out, so I appreciate it.
And, okay, likewise, and I appreciate you having me on. I mean, there's a lot of guys in this game, but this is fun. Once you got this up and running, let me know, and I'll share it on my Facebook page.
Perfect. We'll get it out. All right, that was the Utah Puck Report. Thank you so much for listening. The Utah Puck Report is a KSLSports.com podcast, and if you haven't subscribed yet, then you can. All you got to do is text the word puck to 57500.
And you can also catch us online, too, at kslsports.com and right there at the Arrow website, 1035thearrow.com.
That's awesome. And we want to thank Josh Tilton, our producer. He's the one that keeps us in line, keeps the things rolling. And he doesn't roll tape, as you would say.
He does not.
But he does produce the show in all the digital ways. So once again, thank you so much for listening to the Utah Puck Report.